This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Past Imperfect. I'm Rachel Sylvester.
And I'm Alice Thompson. We're talking to remarkable people who overcame adversity and trauma in their childhoods to become extraordinary adults.
Our guest this week grew up on a council estate in Stockport. Her mother couldn't read or write and suffered from bipolar disorder.
She became a carer to her parent at 10. She was clubbing by the age of 13, pregnant by 15, and had left school with no qualifications by 16, determined to find a job while bringing up her baby on her own.
Yet Angela Rayner is now deputy leader of the Labour Party. We interviewed her first when she was Shadow Education Secretary. She told us, "I still think someone's going to tap me on the back in the corridor here and say, 'You've put on a great show, but the joke's over. Off you pop, love.' I feel like I'm punching above my gene pool."
Angela Rayner, thank you very much for joining us. Do you still feel like an imposter, even though you've been in the Commons for 7 years?
Yeah, I think I hope that people don't sort of look at and listen to their own hype. I certainly don't. And I think when you come from a background where it's sort of implied in everything that you do that things are done to you rather than you're somebody who can achieve things. And if you, I don't want to say downtrodden because that's too much of a harsh word, but there's a subtlety in growing up in my sort of experience that is that know your place. So it takes a lot to come out of that. It's a bit like, you know, I talk about Shawstat and the amazingness of Shawstat, and I'm sure we'll come on to that, but a lot of people think that it's just the natural thing that you cuddle your children, you love your children. And, you know, I'm sure my parents loved me, but they didn't know how to show they loved me. So it was implied as well that you don't get cuddles or anything. So yeah. I've always been like, you know, to get cuddles off my children, I've always had to sort of like learn it. And I feel really sad about that. You know, I look at it now and I think, gosh, you know, I see the natural way in which my husband can have cuddles off the kids and it's great, whereas I still sort of slightly recoil and think, right, oh no, this is good, you need to enjoy it. So I think it's just learnt behaviour. So yeah, so I think I'm still at that point even in my career now where my learnt behaviour is, okay, this isn't really for you. Right. You're not this type of person.
And is that more to do with being a woman or to do with your class background?
I think it's a mixture. I think it's a mixture. And even in my class background, there was like, even on the council estate, there was levels of superiority. You know, like if you were like the big family that were, you know, quite good, or the dad who is like well known in the community, they had status, you know, whereas we didn't have any status. We were like lowest even on the council estate. So even within that, I suppose it taught me structures and it taught me about people, more importantly. So I suppose that's why I've mastered politics in the way that I have, because it is about knowing about the subtleties, the unspoken. A lot of the time people think, you know, you have to go to university, learn about politics, you know, do a degree. Actually, the masters in real life that I've got has been the thing that I've used the most in all my years I've been in Parliament, because you have to be able to understand the unspoken and the subtleties of the way in which communities work and various different communities, and you have to pick up on that. And the chamber's the same, you know. But even when I was growing up, the matriarch women, they were really in charge, but they used to, like, you know, I'd hear about, you know, next door neighbour, her husband used to get drunk all the time, and on a Friday he'd go to the pub and he'd get drunk and spend most of his money. It was cash in hand at the time, he used to get paid cash wages back in the day, and she'd say when he'd come home absolutely hammered, he'd fall asleep on the sofa and then she'd take the money and he'd think he'd spent more money than he had, but she'd take the money for the kids so that she could spend a little bit more of the housekeeping, you know, because the men went out to work. But she was really in charge and the women were, but a lot of the time the men just like to be the ones that bang the drums. But actually I find a lot of the time, and in Parliament, in everything that we do, is that women are actually finding ways to make their mark and improve things. They just don't have to go around willy-waving because that's not what they do.
So do you think, in a way, the women have the real power in politics as well?
I think they do. You know, Harriet Harman, I mean, she's just like, she gets a, you know, she gets on with it. And you see that. You see, you know, people have accused Carrie Simons of the same, you know, Boris Johnson's part. They're like, oh, she's interfering. And I think, actually, you know what? I think women just learn to do things differently. And again, I think that's you know, when I talk about my imposter syndrome, I think that women just learn that there is norms in the environment, that actually there's ways of getting around it. I did a Guardian interview back in 2011 and I said people often underestimate me, and I'm like, do it at your peril. And I enjoy it when they do, because it means that I've got an advantage. You know, I know when I'm in a room that that person has underestimated me. That's great, that's perfect for me, because it makes my life a bit easier when I go for the kill and I want something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think women are incredibly intelligent and have learnt to adapt to whatever their environment is in everyday life or in politics as well. So they may not be as, you know, they may not be a sledgehammer to crack a nut, but they still crack the nut.
And we want to take you back to your childhood. And people sometimes say that politicians don't have enough life experience or not enough knowledge of reality. But in some ways, you've got too much. It's really tough.
Yeah, like, I often get accused of oversharing.
But what's your earliest memory of your childhood?
Oh, gosh. I mean, some pretty horrifying ones, to be honest. I was I used to have really bad nightmares and night tremors, and used to wet the bed, and I used to get really told off. My dad was very scary and very shouty, and if I wet the bed, I got told off. And I used to be absolutely petrified. I used to hide the bed in wherever I could or try and get out of it. And if they needed the loo, I was like absolutely terrified of going to the toilet and things like that. So yeah, it was they were probably my earliest memories. Just I used to like have images of things. I used to think there was like monsters in the room or visions of things, and I was so, I can't even watch films now, like, you know, Critters. People who are listening to the podcast will know Critters. It's, people think it's a funny show. I couldn't watch it. I still can't watch Critters. I get really frightened. And when I was a home help and I used to do the night shift, I remember coming out, and if it was a dark night and it was windy, I used to think, right, 10 seconds to get to the car, shut the car doors, lock the car door, don't look out the window. That's kind of the OCD routine that I had to get me through like the darkness. So I'd always been like scared of the dark. So yeah, I was absolutely petrified, and I used to get told off for being so frightened and making being silly about it and stuff. And I was, and I don't know, I think parents, I don't know, I don't think my dad meant to be so cruel, but it was pretty pretty terrifying when I was younger. So that was my youngest memories, is always being frightened, going to bed, and knowing that going to bed was not a pleasant experience for me. It was an experience of feeling absolute fear,
and then worrying in the morning. There were no sort of hugs and kisses, and there was no affection. They obviously must have loved you in their own way, but why do you think? Was it because they were constantly arguing, or was it pressures of money? Or
I think it was learnt behaviour. It's learnt behaviour, you know, and I look at, you know, my mum come from one of 12, and two of them were just given away to the Christian couple down the road. You know, they just went a couple of days and then they never came back. So that was how it was in them days. Right. A Wivenshaw estate, you know, big estate, poverty everywhere. And it was more the emotional poverty. And this is why I talk about Sure Start a lot. And this is one of the things that, because yes, we didn't have money. And yes, you know, I mean, by today's standards, we had a council house and we had a gyro that covered, we didn't go to a food bank. So by today's standards, actually, we were okay because the welfare state supported us. But it was the emotional poverty and the deprivation. And my mum suffered it. And you can see the effects of that with my mum. And she said, I could only love one person at a time, and that was your dad. And I just think it's that learnt behaviour, and she couldn't emotionally connect to us. And I think I was going the same way. So I thought being a parent was making sure your children were clean, making sure they'd been fed, making sure they got to bed on time, making sure, you know, that the house is tidy. I didn't click in my head that giving positive feedback to a child. I mean, my mum couldn't read or write, so we didn't read when we were babies. So I didn't realise that.
Go to bed. No one. I mean, that you don't have a bedtime.
I didn't
story,
have a bedtime routine or anything. No. I mean, my bedtime routine was trying to get under the blanket as quickly as possible and not think about the monsters that I thought were looking at me. So that was my bedtime routine. So I think, you know, that's why I was such an advocate of early years and Sure Start, because people assume, and it's not just about poverty, you know, people from all different walks of life grow up. And, you know, when I've spoken about the emotional deprivation that I had as a child, it's not intentional, but it's learnt behaviour. Some call it like, oh, it's the Yorkshire way or whatever, you know, it's the northern way. This is how we are in the north. We're stiff upper lip and all that. But some families are just not that way, that they're given kisses and cuddles and told they're loved and everything as a young child. And I think it's so important to learn about giving that positive feedback to a child. And I was a child that stayed up all night screaming, petrified, and I was quite a hyperactive child and as well. So I was probably a difficult child. And therefore, if you're a child that pushes boundaries, which I was, you tend to hear lots of negativity. So it becomes more important then to understand about being positive towards your child as well as telling them off when they're naughty. And that's what it was. Oh, it was an amazing moment for me when I went to Sure Start and when I had Ryan, and just learning about how it was just like a real life-changing moment for me, learning about, oh my God, I have to do these things and it will change. And I knew it was successful, and I got really tearful. I was crying about it. Was when I saw my son pick his daughter up and just naturally cuddled her. And it's like, it sounds silly to say that, but anyone listening who have gone through that sort of same emotional deprivation will understand what I mean. It's like he didn't have to try. It was so natural for him to just scoop his daughter up in his arms and give her a cuddle and say all the things like, I love you and you're amazing. And I thought, yeah, you've done that. You know, you've broke that link. And my mum could never get that with us. Even to this day, me and my siblings, I mean, we just wouldn't like be like that with each other. It's just not our way. So I think to break that chain, I think, is the most amazing thing. If you ask me, all the interventions, I've had some great interventions by the state that have got me to where I am, but that to me was the number one. It's priceless to give my son that opportunity to love unconditionally in a way that makes him feel nurtured and happy. I think, that's amazing.
Was your dad ever violent? He sounds like quite a frightening man. Was he violent to you or your mum?
He kind of thought he was being a good disciplinarian, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah, so he probably thought he was doing the right thing and, you know, making sure that we were well behaved, but it was very scary. As young children, it's very scary. And I think, again, people don't realise how scary they can be. If you're an adult, you know, it's like me now. People look at me now and they're like, oh, she's a big bad politician. She's like deputy leader of the Labour Party. I go into like a college or go to a women's group of teenage mums, for example, and I'll say, like, I'm Ange High, and they'll be like really nervous at the beginning. And then after speaking with me for 10 minutes, be like, you're nothing like I thought you would be. And again, it's that sort of, I think sometimes people don't realise the imposing nature, you know, of how you can be. And I think my dad did what he thought was right at the time, but I was very frightened. I remember my childhood was filled full of fear.
And is that why you like making these huge Sunday roasts? Is that a sort of sense of family, or is it because you do also like feeling that there's food in the house?
Oh yeah, I mean, this is why I've got an obsession with shoes, and my sister's got an obsession with handbags, because we had nothing. So it's like a big thing for us. We never had a Sunday roast.
How many have you got?
So I've lost count, because the beauty of being a politician is I've got two offices and two places where I live, so I can just shove things everywhere, and it's an excuse to buy even more. But my sister's the same, and she's just as crazy as me when it comes to handbags and things like that. But when you have nothing and you grow up with nothing, it's like Sunday dinner is really important, because I used to go around my mates' houses and ask them and say, your parents let me in for Sunday dinner, you know, because that was just like so, and they hated having to go in for Sunday dinner. Like, oh, I've got to eat my Sunday dinner. And I'd be like, can we have some? Because my mum couldn't cook either, so we never had a Sunday dinner at our house. I remember, do you remember beef and gravy, bird's eye beef and gravy in a bag, boiling a bag? That was close. And the smash, that was as close as we got. And processed peas peas. It was always processed peas out of a tin. That was a Sunday dinner in our house. So when I went round my, you know, around my friends' houses and they had proper Sunday dinner with roasties and stuff, it was like heaven. It still is now.
Why is it shoes that you love now? Is that sort of a luxury or frivolous? Why?
Because I had steel toe caps when I was young. Because my nana bought me a pair of black steel toe caps because she said they'd last longer.
Right.
And I remember just getting absolutely bullied for these horrible pair of black steel toe cap shoes. And we didn't have luxuries of shoes and things. No, we didn't. And my mates, I was always taller than my friends, so they were all like a size 6. Now it's a size 8. So I've got like really crooked feet now because I used to squeeze into people's shoes because I used to, like, my friends used to have really nice stuff. And I used to say, can I wear that? And they'd be like, you could try them on. And I used to literally squeeze into my friends' outfits and into their shoes just so I can wear something new. Mm.
And you once said your mum came home with a tin of dog food, and that's because she couldn't read or write.
No, she thought it was stewing steak. Yeah. She looked at the picture.
Oh, I mean, do you just feel angry that she wasn't taught to read and write?
She just, like, even now, like, if she says, like, someone's phone, she puts an F. And that means someone's phone. So it should be great if we're ever in a war situation and you needed somebody to come up with some sort of Morse code. No one would ever decipher one of my mum's messages. But she didn't go to school. She got bullied and she was looking after her siblings. So she never saw the benefit of it. And then as she got older, she just, you know, as we got older, I mean, I said my son had exceeded my mum's reading age by 4. So even now, my children were helping my mum. You know, I used to read to my mum, and we still help my mum, and she still gets support now. She's got some great guys. I should give them a shout out if they're listening, who go in and help her with her shopping and help her read stuff and everything because she's not able to read or write, but she used to look at the pictures. Mm. So we had shaving foam once as well. That was possibly with our jelly, shaving foam and jelly
instead of cream.
Yeah, she thought it was cream and it was shaving foam, and we used to. Make we used to we used to have a laugh about it. We had Imac as toothpaste once. So that was my mum. She's just like, she comes out with some corkers as well. She's really quite entertaining, but she's never sort of let it hold her back. She just sort of gets on with it. She just sees it as that's me.
But as a child, it must have sometimes been quite frightening. How did the bipolar disorder manifest itself? And you were her carer really from very early.
Yeah, age. I mean, at a young age as a child, it was. I didn't know at the time, but that really held us back. My mum's learning deprivation really held us back, and her bipolar, because my mum wasn't motivated to play with us or to entertain us. So we were kind of feral, and she wasn't able to read with us or anything. So we were behind. We wasn't school ready is the term. So I didn't know that at the time, but that's where we ended up. So once we went into the school system, I remember walking my younger sister to primary school. You know, we walked on our own, we got ourselves ready, you know, and I always got bullied because my hair was all a mess. My mum never did my hair or anything, like, hence why my hair's always immaculate now. These are all like issues that,
so would she just be lying in bed while you had to get everything?
So she wouldn't be able to get up. You know, it wasn't that she was so much lazy at the time. We just thought my mum didn't really want to bother with us, but when we were really young, it was because my mum just didn't have the motivation. You know?
And did you feel really embarrassed, or was it more sense of just wanting to protect her the whole time?
I think, I mean, like I say, my nana is a big influence to me, because my nana worked 3 jobs and my nana used to sort of like look after my mum. So, and then when my nana got cancer, that's when I became like a real carer and took on, because my nana was trying to convince my mum that she needed to give her loads of morphine because my nana was in all this pain. I was like, mum, you literally, this is dangerous. And I ended up having to put my nan in nursing care because I had a 1-year-old at the time and I was struggling with work and looking after my mum with a bipolar and looking after my nana, and it just got all totally extreme for me. And my nana said if I was a dog, you'd put me down, and she was so upset that I'd put her in a nursing home, and she was going through so much trauma herself. And that's another reason why I'm so passionate about social care, and that actually people should be treated with dignity and respect, and no one should die in pain on their own. You know, I feel really quite strongly about that, and no family should be put in that position as well, because I've been a formal carer and I've been an informal carer all my life, and I can tell you it's a lot easier to be a formal carer. Looking after someone, seeing a loved one of yours just degenerate in front of your eyes and go through that pain, and them having to be, you know, ask you to do things that they never wanted to ever put on you to ask. I think it's too much to ask families, and I don't think we should. I think we should be able to give
16,
people that support.
You?
Yeah, I was 16, 17, yeah. Mm. So, but I looked after my mum from about the age of 10. So, you know, once I got to an age where... it probably even before then, but my memories of my mum's bipolar being so vivid to me was from about the age of 10, I think.
So what was the worst moment? What was the most sort of distressing thing that you had?
I just
knew
when my mum was going through crisis.
Okay.
I knew when she was going to, because she would, you know, she'd have a row with my dad. My dad would have done something that upset her, and it wasn't like... it would become like a really, it would be like the worst thing, like as if a world had collapsed and everything had ended for her. And she was in a total crisis and she was leaning on me more and more. And I remember thinking, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to keep her safe. And I remember being on the end of my mum's bed one night. My dad used to walk out and he'd be gone a couple of days, or he'd stay out overnight, you know. And my mum would just sob and scream and say, I don't want to be here anymore and everything else. And I'd be sat there thinking, what do I do? I was frightened about what to do with my mum. And I remember lying on my mum's bed at the edge of the bed for the whole night, like really tired, my eyes stinging with tiredness, and thinking, don't go to sleep, because if I go to sleep, if something happens to my mum, it would be my fault. Yeah. And I remember from an early age, and it kind of switched, and the relationship is still like that. So I'm not the daughter.
Yeah.
In my mum's relationship, I'm kind of like the caregiver, always have been. My mum has never really been a mum.
Yeah.
You know, she'll say, I had to bath her, I've had to get her out of bed, all sorts that mum's been through,
And then get up and go to school the next morning.
And get up and go to school, or look after, you know, I had Ryan when I was 16 as well. And this
Did
was
any teacher help you at all, or anyone step in any way?
Not at all, no. In fact, if anything, in when we were growing up, we saw social services and teachers and people like that as the enemy.
Yeah.
So on our estate, you wouldn't say anything about what was going on. I mean, and to be honest, most of the families that I knew had either an alcoholic father or, you know, like recruits like, as they say, we were in that pool, and they were the people that we were around. I mean, I only sort of communicated with people who were professionals once I became a home help and saw them as humans.
Right.
You know, before then, we just didn't even do that. But you wouldn't go to a teacher. I certainly wouldn't go to a teacher and say my mum's had a really bad night where she's been, you know, saying she wants to kill herself. It just wouldn't do it. I mean, you just feel like your mates would laugh at you. You just dealt with it. It was just your reality. And it's only as you grow up, and like I say, it's only even the stuff around not being loved and cared for in a way that is quite common to most people. That wasn't my day-to-day lifestyle, so I grew up thinking that's normal. So the abuse, the neglect, the circumstances of my childhood, I grew up thinking that's normal. And because of the estate I grew up in, there wasn't examples. Of course, there was probably one or two, but certainly not ones that I saw that showed me that things could be different.
It must have sounds very chaotic and quite dysfunctional as well. Do you now feel you have to have everything under control, everything in order, everything very tidy?
No, you see, now the chaos has been why I've thrived so much. Because if you look at since 2015 in Parliament, everything's been chaotic and a lot of MPs have really struggled.
So you're used to it.
And I'm like, you know, this, the trauma, the screaming, the change, the unpredictability, the Brexit, everything is like, this is my bread and butter. This is life. Yeah. You know, this is what I'm used to. In fact, I think it's really strange when people are nice. I find taking compliments more difficult than taking abuse, to be honest, because
I've learned not to trust people, basically, isn't it?
I've just learned that, you know, I don't need that. I've never had that love and affection, so I don't crave it, and that's really sad, because then, like I say, I see how people can be fulfilled by those things, and I can't. There's just something that doesn't, and I don't know if that'll ever change. I'm certainly, you know, I'm more open than my brother and sister about, you know, like I say, I overshare. You know, most people say, oh my God, listen to this, like, she's so, you know, so open about and honest about stuff. But I say that, and I try and do it, because I try and help people not to make those mistakes, because sometimes I think it's a bit late for me, because I can't be loved, because I've never been. So I find it difficult. I find that whole, like, being loved and feeling nurtured and happy. I'm never content.
So do you think that's why you almost wanted to have a child?
Yeah, definitely. I think
that,
I was
that
looking
need for love.
Or? Yeah, I was looking for love and affection as a young person. I was looking for love and affection that wasn't clearly what it was. And then when I got pregnant with Ryan was everything. I was determined to give him everything that I didn't have.
You're listening to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and our guest this week, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner.
We'll be back after this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester, Alice Thompson, and our guest this week, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner.
So you are unusual at Westminster. Most politicians haven't had your background. Do you still feel that the kind of Westminster establishment patronises you? And that might come from both left and right, actually. So the sort of Corbynistas with their Che Guevara t-shirts and the Jacob Rees-Mogg lounging on the benches.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of politicians that are from different political parties that do have a background that's not dissimilar to mine, but they're too frightened to talk about it. Because, like I say, I get told I overshare. And it's not because I want people to go, oh, poor little old Angie, or you're dead inspirational, look at what you've achieved from what you've come from. It's just like, actually, a lot of my colleagues have had adversity. Some of people have spoken about their adversity across the political spectrum. You'll know of that, and some of your listeners will know. So I won't say I'm extraordinary. What's different about me is that I overshare. Because I think talking about it and being a bit more human about these things and being open about it, like with mental health and other things, actually that's a way of supporting people, and it's a better way of living.
But do you think it makes people patronising towards you? Like you said once that you were seen as a bit of a trinket in your party, almost.
Yeah, like... there is some like that. Again, but that's not necessarily a class issue. Some people that have not faced adversity at all are just completely oblivious.
Yes.
And they see it as an ideological political point. Well, as I said, ideology never put food on my table. So whilst you know, I was very vexed about some of the stuff that people were saying about Tony Blair. I was like, well, actually, under Tony Blair, I got Sure Start Centre. I went back to education, free education. You know, I had a council house. I had income support. Gordon Brown did not make me go to a food bank. Mm. So I'm sorry. There may be things that we get upset about, but there's no way I'm going to turn around and say that was a bad thing. That changed my life.
Do you think, in a way, Keir Starmer's a bit too smooth? Because he's always wearing his ties and his suits. And actually, the thing about you is you are wearing leggings or you're wearing boots. Or,
Keir are totally different, yeah.
Yeah, but actually it's great what you
wear.
But
Keir's background as well, this is the point, you see. So Keir's background, his mum was very poorly when he was growing up. He didn't grow up in an affluent background or anything like that. Keir went first to go to university from his family, and he became a human rights lawyer, and I think he had it like beaten out of him from the system. You know, the system does not, like, as a lawyer you're not a touchy-feely person, are you? You're supposed to be methodical and look at the the practicalities and the facts. And
yeah,
I think,
and fit in where
yeah,
they're
seen. So Keir, I think, has just been like, over the years, he's... But, like, you know, when you see him talk about his mum or his family, his little eyes light up and you can see all the amazing things that you'd want from a prime minister. But when he's in the zone, he reverts back into, like, right, this is what needs to happen and these are the ways in which I need to do it. He's just been taught in a way that, you know, I say my mum couldn't give cuddles. Keir's been taught in a way, as a lawyer and other things, you know, is that this is what... You do. You do it in this way. You don't get emotional about it. You get, you know, practical about it. And he sees that as his role. Mm. But he has as much passion as I do to get young people to have opportunity. He gets as angry as I do about kids not being given the food and yet at the same time billions of pounds being given over to Tory donors. He's just as angry as I am. He just articulates it in a different way. But I've seen him, you know, you've seen him at the dispatch box. I loved it when Boris Johnson was going at him saying something about Northern Ireland and, you know, trying to say that, you know, you don't care about Northern Ireland and stuff. And Keir Starmer was like, don't you say that. You know, I was in Northern Ireland. I was prosecuting the terrorists and the criminals while you were, you know, in London chatting on your column that you had as a journalist. So, you know, Keir got really vexed and I'm like, go on. So Keir, I'm like, yay, more of that. More of that care.
But he is like that,
you know, yeah. He does have that passion and he does have that drive to use all of his skills and everything that he's learned growing up to improve people's lives. He just does it. He's just like, I'm like Bolty and he's different, you know, we're just two different types of, you know, ways of doing things.
You're more authentic in some ways about your background. Is that what he should be doing, is just to be...
I like to drag some of that out of him. I say, oh, you should share a bit more. He undershares and I overshare.
Your life has just been so different to Boris Johnson's, though. Yes. even more recently, you had your second child was born very prematurely.
Yes.
And has had a really tough time.
Yeah.
A real fighter. Can you just tell us about that? What happened and how has that affected you? How have you felt about that?
Yeah, well, I call him Little Ilf, and I had a bit of a joke about this because he's called Charles Wilfred. And obviously Boris Johnson's child's called Wilfred. So I was saying, like, mine's a Little Ilf. That's what we nicknamed him. So my son, Charlie, was born at 23 weeks. So he weighed less than a pound. He was 455 grams when he was born. He was so tiny. And I spent 8 months in the neonatal unit and 6 months in intensive care with him. And nearly lost him many times and was told that he wouldn't even be able to feed himself growing up because of the damage that was done to his hemorrhages and his brain and stuff. So we had a very... very difficult time with Charlie, but he's, you know, he's 13 now and he's so amazing. He's just adorable. He's doing great. He's doing really good things. He can't see very well, but he's doing really well. And we're incredibly proud of him. You know, it has been different, and I've never had a nanny or anyone to be able. I mean, I've looked after my mum and things, so you know, I've never had the luxury of being. I mean, I feel like I'm a bit of a charlatan because I go out to work and my husband does the lion's share of the childcare. I feel like that's like, you know, like, oh my god, I'm not doing my job. That feels like a luxury. But you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg and others, they don't have the same concerns that many
in a weird way Boris have. I mean, I know he is very different, but there's an element of Boris Johnson's life that's quite similar to yours, and that, you know, he wasn't, you know, people weren't present in his life as a child. He's got those, so you must understand him in some ways. He hasn't actually been very loved as a child.
Well, that's what I was saying, that sometimes actually
there must be moments when you see him similar.
Do cross like different class so there's some issues that are not class based, you know, like I say, you know.
Well, like having a mother who's a depressive class. That he had, didn't he? There must be moments when you're thinking, I can
exactly.
see why you're acting.
Yeah, and
like
if you're
this.
At boarding school, that could be, you know, even worse than what a childhood of poverty, but lots of love and affection from your parents. So, I certainly don't think everything is about class. But, you know, if Boris Johnson's child is poorly and gets sent home from school, he's not petrified, worried about how is he going to tell his employer that he needs a sick note or that he can't go into work because he's got to pick his kid up. So there is, you know, he never, ever has had to think, I'll pay the gas. I'll pay the loan man because I'll need to loan off him for Christmas to pay for the kids' presents. But I can't pay my gas bill, but they can't cut me off. So therefore, that's the choice I make. Do you understand? Mm. It's like these choices that
it's
some people...
It's gold wallpaper or floral wallpaper.
Exactly, yeah. It's £820 a roll wallpaper, or am I going to get like the £12,000 coffee table? It's not... I've got a mattress that's full of urine. How am I going to change and pay for my children's mattress?
Do you think it makes you more self-reliant if you grow up with that?
I'm definitely self-reliant. Okay. Yeah. I would never, ever, ever ask for help of anybody. Right. I'd rather live on the street than ask somebody to put me up, for example. I'm just very, you know, I left my home at 16. My dad threw me out when I was pregnant at 16 and I'd never go back. Yeah. I was like, no way will I ever, ever need anybody. Right. Yeah, I'm very, very much like that, yeah.
So sort of pride, or is it partly that you don't want to get hurt?
It's just because I'd never want to have to be my mum and look and ask for help.
Okay.
And that's really bad because I'm the sort of person that everyone rings if you've got a problem because I'll fix it and I will give you my last pound. I am that person, but I would never want to feel weak as I see it, which is not weak. Actually asking for help is a very big strength. But I know in my own head that I always had like my plan B fund and things like that. I've always squirreled, even when I had nothing, when I was a single mum, I had nothing. I literally always had something in the bank that meant that I could feed Ryan for a week, for example.
And is that why you're so passionate about politics, do you think? That you see, I remember you saying that you'd lost half a dozen friends by the time they were 18, either to drugs or drink. Or
it's why I'm so passionate and so angry when people think that people on benefits it's a lifestyle choice and things. Because the one thing I knew, and I was with Jim McMahon on his by-election in Oldham, and I'd visited a food bank with him, and I had to go in the toilet and cry because I saw the nappies and I saw the baby food and I thought, I never had to do that. Even though I went to great lengths and I had struggles and I had to have income support, I had income support every week for a few months before I started working as a home help. And I thought, you don't understand how degrading that is to somebody. Like, if I had to go to a food bank to get nappies for my child, I'd die inside. I would die inside. And I think people don't realise or recognise that people are in poverty who can't afford... People say, well, why have you had that many kids then? It's not, you know, people's life chances can change, people's circumstances can change, and I get really vexed by people who look down or look at people and say, well, you're just, you know, you're lazy, or you just want a free life. And I see my friends now, and some of my friends, you know, and I think their life is so much harder than mine, and they've got kids and they're bringing them up, and you know, they haven't got much money and they're working. You know, one of my friends has got six kids and she's working in a local news agent and she's on the breadline, and she was in tears because one her kids wet the bed and she couldn't replace a mattress. And the bed stunk, and I bought mattresses for the babies, and she was like, Angie, she's just like crying. And when the lockdown happened, I gave her my car because they had a second car. Like, it's only an old Golf, but I went round and paid the insurance and gave her the car, and she was like, because she could get to work then, and she was just literally crying her eyes out, saying, Angie, this is the best thing ever. You're like my fairy godmother. But I'm like, people don't realise. They would just look and think, oh, well, she's had six kids. That's her problem, isn't it?
Sometimes in the Commons, you come across as quite angry or even chippy. Is it because of that that you feel really frustrated? That, well, like the comment about Tory scum that you had to apologise for. Was it that you just feel so angry that people don't understand?
I just think it's there, but for the grace of God, you're all right.
Okay.
So who are you to sit there and say, like, I don't look at other people and think I'm better than you. And sometimes, you know, and I've had it said to me that, well, you know, conservatism works. Look, you worked hard. You worked your way up. This is great. Look how great it can be. And it's like, I did not work any harder than the people I grew up with. And I'm incredibly proud of some of my friends who struggle, I'm incredibly proud of my friend who couldn't afford to get the mattress for her kids because she works a lot harder than me. She struggles a lot harder than I do. And I think when people in positions of authority who have never had to worry, when their kid comes home and their shoes are knackered and they say, Mum, I need some new shoes, and there is just no money, and you've got that fear in your stomach, that feeling of like a brick leaning on your tummy thinking, what do I do? how am I gonna do this? Yeah. How am I gonna get shoes for my child? How am I gonna do this? If you've never had that feeling, then who are you to look down on those people? Mm-hmm. Who are you to say, oh well, that's your fault? And I find that incredibly frustrating, because, you know, in there's times in my life where I needed help. I didn't ask to be born into the circumstances I was born into. I didn't ask for a bipolar mother who didn't know how to love me properly. I didn't ask to be negligent myself as a mum at the beginning. But the interventions, positive interventions that helped me be the person I am today, the taxpayers of yesterday that supported me when I needed it, this is what you achieve. That's the positive message that I see in politics. That's what I want to see us as politicians doing. Not looking down and pointing a finger at people saying, oh, it's your neighbour's fault, or it's that person's fault, or it's the immigrant's fault, or it's that. Actually, no, let's talk about how we can build a society where people can achieve great things. And then, you know, they will pay their taxes and they'll be incredibly proud to be able to go to the shop and buy their kids their shoes and, you know, and do all of those things. Because that to me is what socialism is. That's to me politics, is enabling people to live their best life. But then if someone has a difficulty or a tragedy, being a safety net for them, that's what society is. You know, if you have, most people with a disability, it's an acquired disability, they're not born with it. You know, when I was at Home Help, I met professors and some amazing people that have achieved amazing things in their life, but as they're in their dying weeks, they don't think about the achievements they made. They're vulnerable. They need support, they need to get out of bed, they need someone to help them feed them.
Do you find that, I mean, it must do that, you've got all these people with classics degrees or PPE degrees or, you know, who went to Eton, who are slightly kind of, you know, looking down on you or being condescending. It must really irritate you, because you do know so much more than them in so many areas.
Do you know what? It's not just about class, though, because people, I've met some very wealthy people that have had really difficult situations in their life, so they may have acquired a disability, or they've looked after their parents, who cancer can affect everyone and everyone, and it really does. And I've met people from all different walks of life. That it's people who look at other people who have never walked in their path, who have not faced adversity, suddenly going, this is what I think should happen for you. Actually, I think that's you know, I don't think we should judge people, whether they're rich, poor, whatever. You shouldn't judge people. What you should do is you should support people. And I think as politicians, that's our job to do that. I get incredibly frustrated where people think that they know better about somebody else's circumstances or their life. You know, I know about my life, I know what happened to me. That doesn't mean to say that somebody else in my circumstances had the same experience. It worked for me. Having a baby at 16, I turned that into a positive, and it's successful for me. I certainly wouldn't advocate for others, and other people have gone through a lot more trauma than I have. But I just think that for me, politicians really should shut up more and listen more and be compassionate. And that's what our job is to do, is to be compassionate and to build a society. That's what I think separates us. And I do get frustrated when people are very laissez-faire and very what-if about some other people's lives and very dismissive about it. And people were laughing, you know, kids. I was that child that was on the curb that was hungry. I always felt hungry as a child, always felt hungry. And it wasn't my fault. I didn't ask to be in those circumstances. And when we were in the debate about feeding children in school holidays and they were laughing, I mean, it's not laughing for me. And the debate was also about COVID, and they said that, you know, we were making it a political issue. My aunt had died 5 days before. It was like, it's not a political issue, people are dying, this is life and death. So you might think it's a bit fun, to me this is not funny. Somebody's gonna suffer as a result of this, and therefore I don't find it funny. So there's times and places for having a laugh, but it's certainly not funny to mock people who find themselves in poverty or find themselves in those circumstances. I think it's terrible. And I think it was a very serious debate, and that's why I said what I said in the debate, because I was very cross. I thought, you haven't got any idea about what people are going through at the moment. And that's what annoys me, is when people look down on others and don't really understand. You have a responsibility. You see, as a Member of Parliament, for me, it's the best public service job. So people, like, if you're one of my constituents, you go and you vote for me. You're not just voting for me for you, about everything that could affect your life, but you're asking me to take care of your loved ones as well. It matters to me a lot. So when people have put their cross next to my name, I'm absolutely humbled by it. So I think the least you can do is show some respect. So when I'm in that chamber, I'm not in that chamber for me. Mm. I'm in that chamber for every single person that puts their trust in me to give them, help them and improve their lives, because a lot of the time it's not their fault why they're in those circles. That's the point.
Why do you think the Labour Party's never had a female leader when the Tory party has had two? Do you think you could be that leader?
You know, I've been asked that question, and I think I would definitely say, I wouldn't say no, because if I said that, then I'm just being lame like other people. But I've never wanted to be, you know, I've never had a desire or an ambition to be even deputy leader. I think it's an absolute privilege to do it. So I would see it as a duty to do it. If I felt that it was the right thing to do for the party and the right thing to do for the country, then I would step up and do it. But, I think what's more important is that we, you know, Keir Starmer is a feminist. And there's a lot of men out there that are feminists that do promote women and do respect women. You know, when my first conversation with Keir, when we both were elected, and bearing in mind it was in the pandemic and I was recovering from COVID at the time, and we were like on the phone call, it was like a speed date or something, it was a bit weird. And his first conversation with me was, Angie, you've had COVID, I've not. Boris Johnson was very, very poorly, and we was concerned about that. And it was a question of what happens if Boris doesn't make it, because he was very poorly at the time. And then his second sort of conversation with me was, I need to put in place systems that if I get unwell, that you take over the party. Mm. Mm. So I saw it as immediately he respected my role.
Okay.
So he didn't see me as a woman. He saw me as the deputy leader of the Labour Party. And that is what you ask of people, is actually respect people. Mm. And if you respect people and you see women as equals and for their intelligence, then they will be promoted. Mm. The fact that women don't get promoted is often because people don't see that, and they're very unconsciously biased about gender roles, etc. I actually like it when people treat me as a politician, or they respect me for the work that I've done. Like I say, do not underestimate me, because that's at your peril.
And you became a grandmother at 37, which is now really a badge of honour. You might have been nervous about being a young mum, but being a grandmother,
that was really lovely. I loved every minute of it. I mean, it was a budget day, and it was when Hammond was Chancellor and I was trending above him on the BBC. I was granduloring and trending on the budget day, and people were more interested in the fact that I'd become a grandma than they were about how much duty they were going to pay on their on their pint. And so I felt like I'd really made it that day. But I've embraced being a young grandma. I love every minute of it. I will be devastated when I say to someone, I'm a grandma, and they say, oh really, how old is she? Because that means that they've accepted that I'm old enough to be a grandma, instead of saying, wow, really, you're a grandma.
So thinking back to your 15-year-old self, what would you say, and what do you wish you'd known then that you know now?
I wish that I had more knowledge about healthy relationships. And that's why I was so passionate about sex and relationship education in schools. And I was working with the Conservatives on bringing that forward, that legislation. And it's one of my proudest achievements of being in Parliament, was that, because I think people being able to understand themselves and having healthy relationships and what healthy relationships are, not just sexual relationships, but healthy relationships per se, I think it would be incredibly knowledgeable for young people. And it would be a life changer for a lot of people who sit there thinking that they're the problem.
Mm. And Boris Johnson once called you a lioness. Do you feel that that's your animal?
Yeah, I was quite happy with that. I wasn't offended by that at all.
And why? Because you're the one who goes out hunting. The lionesses are the ones who go out hunting for their
Yeah, cats, I'm quite happy to do the work. Yeah, I'm quite happy to hunt, and then I get the best bits of meat.
And do you still have to pinch yourself about what's happened? That, you know, you only became MP of Ashton Online and 2015.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a privileged position that I'm in. Sometimes I worry that, you know, I don't spend as much time with my children that I should. I've learned that it's all relative. You know, regardless, people look at other people's lives and think, oh gosh, they must have it so good, they must be so happy, and they must feel so content. Actually, a lot of people don't, and a lot of people do have inadequacies or insecurities that drive them. And you know, I still have moments where I think, you know, am I doing that right? Am I doing that correctly? And then I just think, you know what, I'm human, and I've got to be honest about those things. And that's why I overshare about it, because I'm not extraordinary. I'm just like every other grandma and mum or everyone else that's trying to get by. And, you know, I think that people who suffer great adversity and still continue are the, you know, the best. And I do volunteering at the moment. Since COVID pandemic, I befriend people in their own home. They don't know it's me. But I've been doing a befriending service and support people. And I think there's some great, they're like so inspirational compared to me. I escaped to my flat and were able to, you know, still keep busy at work. Other people were just like, gone through so much, but to them they'd feel like they weren't coping or that they weren't good and that I'm amazing and they're not. And I look at them and think, you really don't know how amazing you are just to be able to do what you do. And that's how I look at my mum now. You know, for years I saw my mum as weak, and now I look at her and I think, you're amazing to even get out of bed when you feel like that. And it's trying to put yourself in other people's position and understand their point of view, and then when you see that and you see the adversity that they overcome, you think, yeah, human race and people are pretty cool.
Angelina, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester, Alice Thompson, and our guest this week, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner.
This is a Wireless Studios production for Times Radio, produced by Ben Mitchell.
To make sure that you never miss an episode, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and listen back to our previous guests on the Times Radio app.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Past Imperfect.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode or others in this series, please go to our podcast page or website, where there are links to charities and organisations who are there to help.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.